This is side two of the Lohmann tape, dated October 24th, 1981. Mr. Lohmann.
The Russians flew in with low-wing, all-metal, German-built Junkers aircraft. And my dad, this is what I wasn't sure of, but claimed that with these all-metal aircraft, the wings were raised on the tips, and if they wanted to, in this north country, if they wanted to land them in rough country, they could come down and knock off their, hit the ground so that they'd knock off the landing gear, and then they could glide in on the bottom of these metal, of their metal wings, and that they always carried an extra landing gear with them so that they could some way or other raise the plane up and put a new landing gear under. Anyway, that really had no consequence, but the pilot was Morris Slipnave, and the mechanic of the Russian plane was Fabio Parikh. And they flew the bodies back to Fairbanks. And they landed at Teller. My father was spent the night with them at Teller, got acquainted with Slipnave. And then as they flew over Nome in the morning, they didn't land, but they had, out on the edge of town, had a memorial service. At least I can remember that we all gathered for the occasion of the plane skirting over town as it flew on to Fairbanks, accompanied by some of the American planes.
What was Slipnave's nationality?
He's Russian.
He was Russian.
Yeah. And the reason I mentioned Slipnave, because he appears in the story again and was entertained in our home. Reappears in 1934, the Russians had two or three ships that were iced in again. They were trying to come in and prove the Northeast Passage as a commercial sea route. So had three or four passenger type ships, freight type ships, that became marooned and in danger of being crushed in the ice off northern Siberia. Slipnave and probably one or two other Russians, Slipnave was in charge of the expedition, came to Fairbanks and purchased two, I believe they were Fleetster type aircraft, from one of the local companies, hired Bill Lavery from Fairbanks, and who is still in Fairbanks, and Clyde Armistead to go along as the American type maintenance and mechanic who were familiar with the airplanes. And I can remember these two planes flying into Nome late in the afternoon. And of course, any time an airplane got close to town, everybody always went to meet it. And Slipnave, young and impressionable still, backing out in his uniform, backing out of the airplane, and I could, as his coat came up, here was a big revolver sticking in his back pocket. But anyway, as soon as he got down, he asked for Alfred Lohmann, my father, who he had made the acquaintance with in 1930 up in Teller. So Slipnave came down, had a few drinks, and I guess had dinner, and could communicate could communicate reasonably well. It wasn't overly easy. We understand that this isn't verified as far as I can say, but I think my dad always figured that he was later executed in one of the purges over there, over Russia. Well, I can also go on to say, and I sometimes in my talking I lose track of the subject. Slipnave then went to Siberia. These planes, these two Fleetsters, were not adequately, weren't type for airplanes for the job. They were fairly fast, fairly temperamental, as I understand. One of them crashed over in Siberia. The other one came back to Nome and landed at, in those days, the winter airport was a smooth spot of ice out in front of town, out on the Bering Sea. It came back, landed on the beach, getting then close to spring. The ice went out, and the plane sitting on the beach, whether it was Russians or US people, but a team came in. This was a metal airplane, took all the rivets out of the wings so that they can dismount the wings from the fuselage. The tractor hauled it to the down to the freight loading area, and on I think it was May 17th, which at that time was the earliest time that I could ever remember that a ship came into port, the Russian icebreaker Krasin came in. The Krasin had come out of the Black Sea, had crossed the, I think it had to go around the Strait of Magellan and up the Pacific, and had gone up to the Siberian coast, also on this rescue attempt.
Mm-hmm.
The icebreaker Krasin had been built by the British or the Russians back prior to World War I.
Did the Krasin actually put into port in Nome? Did it lay outside?
The Krasin came in to pick up this airplane. Came up to pick up the remains of this airplane, and my father gotten a message from them that they wanted to see if they could buy some coal. It was a coal burner. So Dad went in his enthusiasm. In the spring of the year, coal wasn't too plentiful, but he figured, well, they could probably allow him about 300 tons of coal. So he went out to the ship with that good word, and they literally laughed in his face, because the Krasin, in just normal cruising, burned about 80 tons of coal a day. And when it was in ice, it would burn upwards of about 120, 140 tons of coal a day. So that it would burn almost as much coal while they were loading it aboard as they would could acquire. So they figured that they could make it to some other port. We were quite impressed. They had an open house on board, and we from school were given a tour of the ship. As I mentioned, it was a coal burner. It had 10 boilers, and each boiler had 3 fire doors. And all of the coal was shoveled in by hand. All of the ashes were taken out by hand, and all of the ashes were hand-hoisted by a windlass up on deck. The officers on the ship, and of course you realize this is a communist to where everybody's equal. The officers had their rooms, they had their dining room, had their caviar, I presume had their vodka. But when you got down to the coal shovelers, you had some black bread on the table, and I guess some butter, but it was quite noticeable the differences in the stages of society on that ship, although everybody in fact was supposedly equal.
Did the Russians make it off the ship? Did they get into Nome at all?
So far as I know, they didn't. I don't know. The captain may have come ashore, but I don't think anybody. It was a one-way communication on that deal.
Mm-hmm.
So far as I can remember.
That's interesting. We talk a lot about Nome seems to have had a share of foreign visitors. Was there any federal outpost? Anybody that represented Washington in Nome? I mean, who was the highest Washington official? Or federal official?
Well, the highest dignitary in Nome would be the federal judge. He would be the highest federal person.
Mm-hmm.
Up until, I don't remember when it finally closed, but we did have a U.S. Customs office there up until early 30s or late 20s, I don't recall. But generally, I would say the district attorney and the judge were the top people, and then had considerable other, not too many others. Postmaster, of course, was federal.
Oh, was there a circuit in Alaska in that time? Like, for instance, was there still commissioners who traveled around to hear grievances?
I would say no. I don't know what year they were established, but you had your four judicial divisions: Nome, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. And basically, I think the court in Nome just sat in Nome. I don't think it traveled.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it traveled. Of course, in the real early days, initially only had one judge, and he had to travel all over the country. But those things pretty well get consolidated in later years. I might mention my grandfather Lohman was a federal judge from about 1921 to about 1931. Well, we might as well just talk, since the Lohmans made their name in reindeer, we might try and talk just a little bit about the reindeer industry. Reindeer were imported over a period of years in the late 80s and early 1900s, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Approximately 1,200 and some reindeer were imported from Siberia into Alaska up in the Teller area for the purpose of providing subsistence to the Eskimos due to the almost complete lack of game in the northwestern area. Since the Eskimos were not familiar with the care and maintenance of reindeer, which is a semi-domesticated animal, government imported Lapps from northern Finland, northern Norway.
How did the white and both the Eskimo communities react to Lapps? What was Lapps' status? Were they considered?
Well, initially, I would say that was no problem because they were just strictly basically with the.
They weren't in town.
And with the reindeer, they at that time, originally, they weren't in town.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't in town. I can digress a little bit, which is probably all right, just another little story. some of the labs after their completion of their contracts with the government went back to Lapland. Quite a number just went home. Some of the labs, one of the communities, Union Fleet, attracted quite a number of labs who may have intermarried with the Eskimos or for one reason or another, but anyway, they settled in Union Fleet. And during World War I, supposedly, Unalakleet had the highest per capita purchase of war bonds of any community in the United States. Which my dad used to attribute to the Laps, their frugality, and they were patriotic and so forth. But supposedly they had the highest per capita purchase of war bonds.
I never heard that.
I can't verify. That's a story that I've heard for forever. But anyway, the Laps came over. They worked with the reindeer, with the natives. And they were on a contract. Part of their pay was reindeer. In other words, they would be given, I presume, so many reindeer per year as their part of their compensation. At the end of their contract, the reindeer belonged to them. In the fall of 1914, one of the first contracts had been completed, and my father and an Eskimo boy walked from Nome across Seward Peninsula to the Candle Kewalik area. With father had $5,000 in his money belt to purchase this herd of reindeer. He made the purchase, however, the Lap refused the money but wanted a check. So that started off the Lomans in the and their associates in the reindeer business. Other herds were purchased both from Laps and from some of the missions who had also been given deer and wished to dispose of them. So that over a period of possibly 10 years, quite a considerable number were purchased. However, reindeer breed fairly rapidly, doubling in population about every 3 years. So that very shortly after the start of this, there was, at least on paper, several hundred thousand reindeer in ownership. I can remember in my some of my first memories was the fact that particularly in the fall of the year, my father would be absent for probably several months. It was during this time that he would be with the reindeer herds and herders at various locations that the reindeer were being taken care of. And of course, you realize that in those days, to get there and to get back was by dog team, so that most everything was accomplished over quite a considerable period of time. One of the largest and best herds was up in the Buckland area, up on the northern part of Seward Peninsula and up back of Kotzebue. So that was a several day trip just to get up there. I might mention that the Seward Peninsula and part of the mainland was either formally or informally divided up so that the Lomans had their sphere of influence where their herds were maintained both winter and summer, which would sometimes be different areas. Reindeer continually on the move. The villages, native organizations would have their areas of in which to maintain the reindeer. The herds.
Was the town of Nome? I mean, the people, for instance, who weren't directly had nothing to do with reindeer. Were they aware of how large the reindeer industry was, or how large it was becoming? Did it affect their lives in any way?
Oh, and to a small degree. Initially, the Lomans financing as such was accomplished by people in Nome who were willing to make an investment as a gamble, say, or as a true investment to start a new industry. But as I mentioned earlier, gold mining was going down, so that the economy was going down, so that the availability of that type of money was becoming less and less. And then there was a bank failure, one of the major banks up there failed, I don't remember now, 1920, 1921, and that literally wiped out, I believe that wiped out almost completely the any source of local capital. It was quite a blow to that area. The Lomans, how they were able to carry on, I'm not sure, but they did various means and tried to promote the sale of reindeer. They had started to harvest or butcher some, and started the promotion of reindeer meat in the southern states. Tried to utilize the leather, reindeer fur, reindeer hides. Incidentally, reindeer hide, good condition, is excellent fine leather. One of their large promotions over two or three year period was the utilization of reindeer for publicity on Christmas ventures in the States. Usually this was done in association with one of the large newspapers in a city, and possibly a large department store who would contract for a team of reindeer to appear at the time of their kickoff for their Christmas promotion, and then to have reindeer available for display in their store or in their various promotions. This started in about 1920. 25, possibly prior to that. The ship, they contracted with the newspaper and long in October, the newspaper would say that this year we are going to have the true Santa Claus in town.
Mm-hmm.
We have contracted with the Lomans in Nome to hire whatever they need to go locate Santa Claus and to bring him to New York, Detroit, St. Louis, whatever, wherever. And there would be then a running commentary. Santa had been located. He promised to be there. To save wear and tear on his reindeer this year, he was going to ship them. Then there would be the plotting of the boat as it left Nome or left Golovin to Seattle, train across the United States. On the given day, here would be Santa Claus with his reindeer. In 1925, they shipped out, and in the meantime, they had chosen some reindeer, and if you keep them in under control with people around them in a very short time, they become quite docile, quite tame, really out of your hand. Fairly easy to handle if handled properly. So these teams of reindeer would show up, and they had Eskimos along to help take care of them. It was quite a promotion, as is normal with a lot of their promotions. They ran into lots of problems, and I don't believe it was ever monetarily successful, but they had lots of fun, met a lot of people, got a lot of publicity. That only went on for a couple of years, and it was just too hard to keep control.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried, in many instances, they tried to keep the reindeer over from season to season. But for handling, for feed, and so forth, that was never successful. They weren't, had not yet learned a lot of the scientific things of handling animals and so forth, maybe in existence at this time. And of course, also at that time, they were also trying to sell meat and were reasonably successful. However, it poses a problem because of the nature of butcher shops, that so many of them were not equipped to handle frozen meat. And they realized also later that their merchandising was left a little bit to be desired. Rather than trying to sell the whole animal, rather than trying to sell the entire animal, entire carcass, they should have taken the merchandise, only the choice cuts, and used the cheaper cuts for canned meat or some lower grade product, which they did do eventually, but originally, they tried to merchandise the entire meat carcass.
Was there any kind of a viable market for reindeer meat in the United States in the 20s and 30s?
Well, in the 20s, it was building up. It was building up. It was a slow start. And, of course, originally, they had transportation problems. There was not adequate cold storage facilities on the boats that ran into the Nome area, and since we only had one steamship company, I one regular steamship company in the known area.
Who was that?
That was the Alaska Steamship Company, which was a subsidiary, wholly owned subsidiary of Kennecott Copper Corporation, who had gotten in the transportation business so they could haul the copper ore out of Cordova from the Kennecott mine. But they refused to provide adequate cold storage facilities on their ships to handle the quantity of reindeer that were desired. So the I didn't mention that with the lack of financing that eventually Lomans were successful in getting Arthur and Leonard Baldwin of New York City prosperous and prosperous and well-known lawyers in New York City to fund their desires in expanding the business. I believe this happened in the spring of 1926. And for a few years, they were adequately financed to build cold storage plants, to build corrals, to establish trading stores or supply stores at their various key spots, to have some small water transportation, and because of the refusal of Alaska Steamship to provide cold storage, one of the Baldwin brothers went out to San Francisco and purchased an old lumber carrier and had it refrigerated, and so then they were in themselves in the ocean going steamship business. This didn't have to be a steamship, it happened to be a very underpowered semi-diesel, but it did put them in the ocean freight carrying business, since they had to make the trip to Nome to pick up the reindeer. They had to help pay for the trip, they had to carry cargo north, so it became an immediate competitor of Alaska Steam.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the viable meat market. I believe, figure could be wrong, but I believe when the crash came in 1929 that they had some 25,000 carcasses of meat in Seattle for distribution. With the buildup of the market, I would assume that was their expected market or expected volume for the coming year, which would indicate that they had built up a reasonable market. Then, of course, when the crash came and prices dropped and beef was as competitive as reindeer, they were hard row to hoe for the future. And although they did continue to make some shipments in future years, the industry was on a downturn. They did one of their successful later ventures, successful part of the later venture was the getting into the canning of reindeer meat as dog food. And they developed what they called a White Rover dog food, and the merchandising was very successful. However, they didn't manufacture it themselves. Low value product, like Swift and so forth. You have to do the whole job from start to finish to make any money. So that they eventually faded away.
When do you think your father and your Uncle Carl, do you think they actually came to a decision? Do you actually think, like, in the beginning of the 30s, especially with a committee meeting, that it was time for them to ever indicate to you that they were ready to leave the reindeer industry? That they felt that they'd, you know, done their best for 15 years?
I would, it'd be my... I would hazard a guess that up until about 1932, I don't know why I picked that year, maybe 33, that they still were sincere. Well, they're always sincere, but they were still dedicated to making an effort to make a success out of their endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that. After that, of course, we were in the Depression in the United States. Other factors that they still maintained the industry in a, say, a holding pattern. In other words, they kept up what they had. They had their annual markings, their annual roundups. They kept a few people on the payroll. In other words, they were in a holding pattern.
And then when
the actual, they did reach a point where they realized there was no future. And when the takeover came, they were all in favor of it. Or in my opinion, it later developed into confiscation, but that wasn't the intent of the government initially, and it wasn't what was expected from the moment. But the only way they could see that for the good of the country, to say, and I guess I have to say for themselves, was for them to let the government take it over. The
mm-hmm.
government had been trying for years. I remember in the late 20s and early 30s, practically every year, there would be some type of a hearing, congressional, interior-wise, or something, wherein Lomans would be investigated, required to testify under oath, and as my father used to say, once you went to court and were acquitted, you were finished. You could only be in jeopardy once, but they were in jeopardy about five times. As far as I know, nothing was ever proven was wrong, but nobody would ever acquit them either.
That leads me to pose the question, do you think Alaska was well represented in Washington, in that Washington had an accurate view of what was happening in politics and in Alaska? The people that were passing laws at a federal level, did they understand what they were doing to Alaskans or to Alaska as a country?
It gets to be, as far as I'm concerned, when you get government interplay with common people, it gets to be a pretty complex subject. We had, in this entire reindeer industry, we had a great number of forces at work. You had Well, let me say that in the various villages in Alaska, you've had a government school teacher work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, that's Department of Interior. When the reindeer were imported, the teacher was the government representative. He was the kingpin in the community. You also, in many of the villages, had missionaries of various types and kinds and calibers, who also had a sphere of influence. You had the Lomans coming in on a commercial basis, in many instances actually buying reindeer, or the natives would sell reindeer to be butchered. So they had, you had a commercial influence which could distract from your missionary and could distract from the sphere of influence of the teacher. Then we also had the commercial antagonism that had arisen when the Lomans became involved in ocean shipping in competition to Alaska Steam. Alaska Steam being owned by the Kennecott Copper, and as I understand, most mining companies very much dislike interference in their spheres of influence. And they felt that they aided and abetted very much of the antagonism that developed through the years in the reindeer industry. Mentioned that the teacher was the department, worked for the Department of Interior, and there was some commercial antagonism developed in that regard, in that the Alaska Railroad was very desirous of the reindeer being driven from Alaska into the interior and shipped to the States on the via the Alaska Railroad. Also, the Alaska Railroad at that time operated the riverboats and would haul freight from Nenana almost down to the mouth of the Yukon. Romans, in their interest of hauling freight from Seattle, would bring freight into St. Michael, and some freight would be hauled upriver. And this was resented by the Department of Interior. The purpose of this last few many comments is to show the many problems and many diverse influences which are involved in the reindeer situation, many reinforced and amplified one or another, and eventually made the entire industry completely untenable. Also, the Department of Interior operated for the Bureau of Indian Affairs operated a small ship, initially the Boxer, which was quite small, and then the North Star 1, 2, and I believe 3 now, to supply the natives and the government schools. This was up to democratic enterprise with no realm of costs, so that if they, and when they did haul some reindeer meat to the States, there was no transportation assessed against that meat, and even though it was a small amount, they would undercut the price and help to destroy the entire market. The eventual outcome was that in approximately 1938, a law was passed by Congress which made it unlawful for white people to own reindeer in Alaska.